Good morning. It's an honor to be part of this panel. In my wrap-up of this session, I want to propose the idea that together we redesign our schools to make reducing inequality in all its forms a priority. Today, too many of our schools reproduce and promote inequality. By ourselves, no one of us can bring about this transformation. But as organizers for a new social movement, we have the potential to write the next chapter of American democracy. I have no conflicts to disclose. I put up this image to remind us of the importance of disclosing conflicts. Other panelists have talked about the virtuous circle of education and health, in which more education leads to better health, and which in turn leads to better educational achievement. And our challenge is to find out how we can accelerate this virtuous circle. And these are some of the questions that by answering, we provide public health professionals with powerful new tools for advancing health equity. My friend and colleague, Sandro Galea, and his colleagues showed that the lack of a high school diploma was associated with 245,000 deaths in the year 2000, calculated as attributable to low education. This is comparable to the number caused by acute myocardial infarction. That was about 192,000 deaths, a subset of heart disease, which was the leading cause of death in the United States in 2000. So by eliminating high school dropout, we could save about 200,000 lives a year, prevent 200,000 premature deaths a year. That's what's at stake. It's really miraculous what a powerful protection education offers against almost every imaginable adverse health outcome across the lifespan. And some of my colleagues have talked about some of the connections between health and education. These lists of mechanisms and pathways show some of the ways that education and health influence each other. Finding out how to intervene in these complex relationships is a priority for both health and education researchers and advocates. As researchers, we can help to improve the health outcomes of education by identifying the specific ways it contributes to various dimensions of health. And as advocates, we can promote policies that reinforce the pathways between the two. I propose that an appropriate public health and educational goal for the next decade is to create schools whose curricula, programs, and policies reduce inequality in all its forms. Educational, health, income, power. Inequality or inequity busting schools promise to improve educational achievements, reduce health inequalities, and restore our democracy that has been distorted by several decades of transferring wealth and power from the 99% of the population to the 1%. And the question we have to ask is, what would it take and what can we do to begin this transformation? So these are maybe some characteristics of schools that could help reduce inequalities. Paul Farmer has talked about privileging the poor, by which he means making the most disadvantaged the biggest beneficiaries of social policy. Unfortunately, sometimes the reverse of what we do today. By examining every feature of our school for its potential to create equal opportunities for all, we can begin to make schools that promote equity rather than reinforce inequity. I I also wanted to just highlight the importance of when we talk about education as a right, that we also talk about higher education. And this shows the decline in spending in states between 2008 and 2013 in spending on higher education. Arizona cut spending by more than 50%, Massachusetts by 37%, California by 29%, and New York, my state, by only 15%. Only Wyoming and North Dakota have increased public funding for higher education, probably because of their revenues from fracking. Another important goal for Healthy People 2020, or perhaps 2030, is to make higher education accessible and affordable to all who can benefit from it. So Terry, next year in New Orleans, a panel on health and the right to college. High school graduation should be the floor, not the ceiling. So let's talk a little about what we can do, what health professionals can do. And I'm going to talk briefly about seven different strategies listed here. And I'm, of course, happy to send these slides to people who want them and have my email address in the end to not make anybody get a cramp in their hand. So first, by making school dropout not only a health and an economic and an education issue, but also a social justice issue, we have the potential to bring in the social movements that have always been the power that have advanced democracy in this country. And I think we've heard from the previous panelists some of the many sectors and constituencies who can be engaged in this right, not only to reduce school dropout, but to make schools promoters of equity and equality. Second, as health professionals, we can use exactly what we're paid to do, what we learn how to do, to engage young people, children, parents, and communities in schools. As Chuck Bosch told us, research shows that caring adults keep kids in school. Caring adults keep kids in school. And health professionals who can reach out and connect to kids through school-based health clinics, through the health education classroom, through school food programs, through after-school programs, through violence prevention programs, through anti-bullying programs, are magnets that can keep kids and parents in schools. This image is a mental health clinic in a school. Imagine your kid has a psychological or mental health problem, and you can go to your school to have that problem addressed. That's going to pull you into that school and keep you connected to it. Third, we can contribute, and I'm now speaking as researchers, the evidence that supports strengthening the health and education virtuous circle. We need to make sure that the evidence we heard in this session today is brought to every principal, every school board member, every commissioner of schools, every health commissioner, every health department, and every hospital director. Those are the people who can build the links between this virtuous circle at the local level, at the state level, and at the national level. And we're the ones who can bring this evidence to them. We can all do that, right? That's what we're trained how to do. Fourth, we need to challenge the ideological attack on government, on taxes, on democracy, and on equity. The policies that have created unequal schools, disparate access to health and community services, and pervasive racism are not accidents. Those who advocate less spending on schools, more tax cuts for the rich, further privatization of health care, less funding for school-based health centers, promote those policies because they help to maintain a status quo that benefits them. Supporters of austerity have recognized that the fight is in the political arena, not in academic journals. We need to engage in all the arenas where the decisions about our children's future and the nation's health are being made. We can't afford to confine ourselves to the settings in which we feel comfortable. As Van Jones recently observed, it's not that the government is broke, it's that we've been robbed by the biggest transfer of wealth from the poor and middle classes to the very rich in American history. Reversing this transfer to the more equitable tax pattern of 30 to 40 years ago would essentially erase the current deficit and give us the opportunity to invest in the human resources that have always made this country great. I sometimes hear health professionals say they don't want to get involved in political arguments. To my mind, that's like doctors saying they don't want to get involved with bodies or illness. And this just shows you the rise in inequality, which I think is the backdrop for our dropout crisis of today. We need to connect our work to the existing social movements. Riding the waves of these movements can take us much further along the beach than if we try to go on our own. I'll name a few of these movements. The Movements for School Equity seeks to guarantee every child equal opportunity in education. The Immigrants' Rights Movement, which has forcefully argued that every person should have access to the dream of higher education, even if their parents are undocumented. The Gay and Lesbian Movement has fought against discrimination and bullying. And the women's movement has fought for, among other things, the right of all women, including young women, to sexuality education, birth control, prenatal care, and abortion, as well as the right to participate in school sports, a major victory relevant to health. And finally, we need to build leaders. This image shows you young people visiting their state assembly member. We need to engage young people themselves in creating a new movement for health education, for health and educational equity. No one will benefit more from more equitable schools and health centers than young people. No one has a greater stake in bringing about the needed changes, and no one has less to lose by ending the current inequitable status quo. Throughout history, young people have contributed the fuel that powers social movements: passion, commitment, energy, humor, and courage. It was young people, with of course some help from their elders, who ended legal segregation in the country. Young people who got us out of the war in Vietnam. Young people who built an environmental movement, a women's movement, and a gay and lesbian movement. Young people who led the fight against apartheid in South Africa. Us oldsters, as my son calls us, will be around to help, to share our lessons, and to offer advice when we're asked, and maybe even sometimes before we're asked. But the future of a movement for health and educational equity in the United States lies in the hands of young people. Thank you very much.
So once a public school educator, always a public school educator, and so as a public school educator and public health professor, I just want to thank all of our panelists for the ways in which they have encouraged us to think about linking these two silos in ways that actually make sense and in very practical ways. So because everyone was so generous to follow the guidelines and my little flashcards, we have time to take some questions. So are there any questions? Yes.
Many of the symptoms that you addressed, dropouts and health problems, vision, hearing, and dental, you did not mention, and hyperactivity and so forth, seem to me to be symptoms of poverty, and only the last speaker directly addressed that. Do we have some evidence that addressing these symptoms are going to bring about a change that we want to see in better outcomes for our youth?
You can take that mic right there. Sure.
So I don't think any one person or any one group has all the answers to solve these problems. I think what we do know
across this country, if we can make that connection to them, which I know we can now, that, you know, being healthy in a myriad of ways is going to advance their ability to do great things. I mean, just that mindset alone is different than when I was going to school, when it was principal school, and we had hygiene classes. Mm-hmm. And I was the closest to public health we were getting. And then we didn't want to go there. But I'm saying that the dialogue and the narrative around this can change. I see my opportunity, you know, that I can help young men to see that if I'm healthy, the gateway is open. There's a program in Philadelphia, Temple University Hospital. Many of you may know about it. It's called Cradle to Grave. Because a lot of the communities where I work in, gun violence is huge. And so this program is started by the health community, the medical community at Temple University, takes these young men through what it means to live the life of 16-year-older Antoine James, who was shot 24 times, and so they can visually see the impact of what this horrendous act of violence can do. So I think it's really changing that mindset to a new paradigm that I'm excited about.
So I think both poverty and poor educational achievement are symptoms of a deeper problem, which is inequality and lack of democracy. And I think what the insights from social determinants of health is about is we recognize it's about the system and that we need to be addressing the health-harming characteristics of our system in every front, any front they manifest themselves. And so that means for people who work in schools, doing that in schools, for people who work in communities, doing it there. And I don't think we benefit from pitting these against each other. What we're about together is creating a society where the kinds of inequalities we see in every front are no longer visible or acceptable.
I'm just going to take Terry. I saw a hand in the back. Yes, in the middle, the shawl, the pretty shawl. That's really the connectiveness you were talking about, right? Did someone want to speak to that?
First of all, I'm completely in accord. I think we were trying to rush to 15 minutes to get it all in. But I know the Expanded Success Initiative is one of the initiatives that we are excited about because it does make the connection between what happens in school, what happens in preparation for careers and college readiness, and the assignment of internships, multiple internships across the board. It's what we do with young men. So, I mean, the education community, I think more and more seeing that experience and opportunity, life-changing opportunities, needs to be present. And so we're building in that kind of scaffolding within the school reform community.
Yeah, I was just going to add that, and for that particular subgroup of dropout, we call it fade out. It's very important for kids to just need to have that horizon expanding opportunity to show that you actually can, by continuing your education, have many more opportunities than you choose to stop you from having in your education.
I was going to just say that, yeah, after school programs are clearly important. We've been focusing a lot on high school graduation, and for my
question? Turtleneck. Right. Yes, that's you. I'm sorry. Anybody? Nate, did you want to say something? And then Terry, I'd like to exercise moderator prerogative and ask you, after Nick speaks, to mention about WKKF and how the student advocacy and their connectedness.
A doctoral student of mine did a participatory research project engaging young people in looking at their schools and how their schools made them feel healthy or not healthy. And a lot of that had to do with the school making them feel recognized and worthwhile. A lot of the negative feelings came from the messages they got around race, gender, and sexual orientation. So I think we need to look in a different way at school environments. It's not only what goes on in the classroom and the instruction, but whether our schools make young people feel welcome and valued. And I think that also will require a transformation of how we do business in schools to make more people feel, more students feel more valued. And I think that is, that again, we have programs and initiatives that have been successful in that, and we need to do more of that. And by the way, the person who wrote that up that is Jessica Ruggles, and she's published them on it, and I recommend people looking at it.
Terry, did you want to?
So one of the So the program that Janita's referring to, and I'm the Kellogg Foundation, it was a policy initiative around school-based health centers and securing their future viability and sustainability through policy. And the program, I could go on for the rest of the day to talk about it, but the piece that Janita's referring to had to deal with youth engagement. And the foundation at that time was very committed to every major initiative having a youth engagement component. And when they talk about youth engagement, it wasn't just your A students. They were talking about going for the CD student, who in effect is a leader in their own right, okay, and engaging them in the work of policy advocacy, advocating for the things that they thought were important to their success, using those same skills that can be used in a way that is derogatory or negative, and turning it around and engaging that same skill set in advancing favorable policy in school. They changed policies in the school building around even time breakfast was served. They were the ones who advocated for that. Having a safe place to play, they advocated for. Changing school policy about type of milk that was available in the school. A number of policies that they went to state capitals on a regular basis. I saw, I think it was Nick had a photo around immigration rights, I believe it was. But really going up to those young people who are those that are the yellow flags in terms of challenge or having difficulty succeeding in that environment or the environment that's failing them, turning that energy in a different direction. And we have video on our website of them talking about it, their experiences, and really it came out of the school-based health center was the champion around that and pulling them into being a leader in their school.
Thank you. I think we've got time for the gentleman right here in the middle.
I want to commend the speakers. It's been a very interesting presentation. One theme that I think you nicely articulated is that we have a silo problem,
yeah,
where we have the public health community and the education community, and that we need to foster
So tomorrow is election day.
Right.
In many places across the country. And I think the future leaders for our country, whether it's national, state, or local, are those who really force those conversations and bring people to the table. I know under this administration, under this president, we have many meetings where we're interacting with colleagues from other departments, from other agencies, and trying to talk about common ground in health or other issues. The more we elect leaders who are bringing people together, people who thought they weren't natural allies on anything, and having conversations like this, I think the better off we're going to be. So part of it's our job to reach out beyond our own departments and silos, but that can be very, very hard. It's a lot easier if you have a leader above you who's thinking that way and bringing people together on a regular basis. So think about that tomorrow and beyond.
I think, Nick?
And I would emphasize both the importance of the sort of top-down interacting with policymakers at all levels, local and national and state, but also the bottom-up approach, and that each of these issues has advocacy organizations and social movements. And I do very firmly believe that the kinds of transformative changes come about only when it's a social movement powering them. And so bringing those movements together. And I think folks in public health can play an important role by creating spaces where people in those different movements can move and talk about common ground strategies. And health, I found, is a very good vehicle for bringing people together across sectors to begin that discussion.
So please join me in thanking our panel. So remember to vote and enjoy the rest of your conference. There are packets in the back of the room from the Center for School Health and Education.